I have got a very special episode for you this week, just in time for Halloween. As we are now firmly entrenched in the Halloween season, you might be wondering, what's it all about anyway? How did this crazy magical holiday come to be? I have author and Halloween historian Lisa Morton on to discuss the origins of Samhain and its evolution to Halloween as we know it. So don't you dare go anywhere, because Lisa Morton's about to drop some knowledge.
I'm Alan Brill. Welcome to Brilliant, a podcast from the mind of Brill. Warning, it gets dark in here.
I have long been fascinated with Halloween, and although there's a ton of false information out there, the origins of it have always been elusive. Lots of bad information has been doled out throughout the years, passed along through pop culture and word of mouth. Even the specials aired on television, they just forwarded along the bad, doled information, and you know, they sensationalized it, of course, it's TV. So, I dove into the books, and I read a ton of history on Halloween just to get the real deal, and one of my favorite books on the history of Halloween is called Trick or Treat, and it was written by today's guest, Lisa Morton, and I'm so excited about it. Let's just get right to it.
Winter's deadly freeze will soon be here, trapping us in our homes. Huddle around the fire as we await the spring. The dark is coming. Halloween is here. And to talk to us about this mysterious holiday, I brought in the Queen of Halloween, Halloween expert and author of Trick or Treat, A History of Halloween, Lisa Morton, to help untangle the roots of our favorite holiday. Screenwriter and author of 4 novels and 200 short stories. Her awards include the Bram Stoker Award, the Rondo Hatton, and the Black Quill. Lisa, welcome to Brilliant.
Hey, thanks, Alan. Happy to be here.
I brought you on today to talk about everybody's favorite holiday, Halloween. Seems like it's everybody's favorite holiday in the last 10 years or so. And there are just a lot of misconceptions about the origins of Halloween. And they've really stuck to it. And, you know, frankly, I blame Charles Lancey. What can you tell us about his contributions to the...
That's a good place to start. It definitely is one of the biggest misconceptions that I've run into over and over again, which is that Halloween is based on the worship of some kind of Celtic lord of death. And you can draw this, a direct line between that belief back to an exact moment in history, which is not always the case. But in this one, it is what happened. There was a guy named Charles Lancey. He was an 18th century surveyor. He was sent to Ireland to map out Ireland on behalf of the British throne and so forth. And while he was there, he became obsessed with Celtic history and lore. And the Celts, in case people don't know, were a conglomeration of tribes that were all over Europe and the British Isles. We don't know a lot about them because they didn't keep their own written records, but we do know about the ones in Ireland in particular because of Irish monks who came up around the 7th century AD and tried to Christianize and convert these people. And they recorded a lot of the history of the Celts and the folk tales and so forth. So Lancey was a guy who was studying all of this, and he ends up publishing 6 volumes of all of this material he's collected. These 6 volumes find their way into libraries all over the world. Just one problem: he was incredibly wrong. He was denounced by virtually every other historian as like the worst historian ever. And he just threw out all of the accepted translations and history that had already been established. The Celtic holiday that Halloween kind of derives from was called Samhain. And he just arbitrarily decided Samhain did not mean summer's end, which was the accepted translation, and that instead it referred to a lord of death. So this is the mistake that has fueled this belief now for centuries.
Yeah, I'd like to point out, again, as you said, he's a surveyor. He wasn't a historian, an anthropologist. I think he was just in the pub, and as long as he kept buying drinks, people just kept telling him stuff. Oh, yeah, let me tell you about this one.
Well, there was a belief at the time that some historians followed, which was trying to draw historical lines between Indian beliefs, Far East and Indian beliefs. And he found the name of one deity in India that was spelled Saman, and it's very close to Samhain. So he just threw out what Samhain was known to stand for and decided, oh no, it's this Indian deity. And then he further decided the Indian deity somehow was worshipped by the Celts and was a lord of death.
Well, sure, it's easy to make that connection, I guess. But, you know, we're going to untangle the origins of this holiday, and it shouldn't take us too long. It's pretty straightforward to get to Halloween. But I guess we'll start with Samhain. And for my listeners, I don't know, when you see it in print, it's Samhain. So you hear Samhain, people refer to a lot. And it makes me cringe a little bit, but I give them a pass, because if all you've ever seen is seen it in print, then, yeah, you know, fair enough. But that's a great place to start for the origins, if you want to talk just a little about that.
Yeah, it was one of the four biggest holidays in the Celtic calendar. They called them quarter days. And Samhain was their New Year's celebration. It was a time when they thought that the veil between worlds was at its thinnest, because it was this sort of borderline time. Their Samhain was when they did a lot of their harvest. They brought their stock in from the fields. They kind of hunkered down for that long, cold Irish winter. And they told ghost stories. This is part of that lore that I mentioned earlier that these missionaries were copying down for us. And some of the ghost stories that we have that survive are still really scary. They're very creepy and weird. The Celts believed in these malevolent fairies called the Shi, and if you've heard the word banshee, this sort of wailing demon that predicts death in a household, that part, that Shi part of that, is from the Celtic word. So we're not talking Tinkerbell Disney fairies here. We're talking these scary things that would cross over on Samhain and do terrible things in the human world. They would burn down palaces. They would bring corpses to life. They would kidnap innocent people and take them back to their world. So they were really scary. And I think that that is where Halloween gets its macabre side from. There is a little bit of an argument among people who study Halloween that it derives more from the Catholic side of things, from All Saints Day and All Souls Day. But I don't see a lot of macabre stuff around a bunch of saints. Yeah, I know there were guys who could keep talking after their heads were cut off, but I really see the whole ghost and spooky side of it coming more from that Celtic great-grandma, I think.
And as you mentioned, the Catholic Church, because now we have Halloween. I mean, how does that relate to Samhain?
Yeah, the Catholics had a really smart way of converting people. They called it the syncretism. And what they would do is, when they would come into a place where there were lots of existing celebrations and religion and temples and so forth, they found out they were way more successful in converting those people if they co-opted that stuff rather than destroying it or stamping it out. So they actually moved the date of their saint celebration to November 1st to co-opt that day that Samhain happened on. Originally, the celebration of the saints was May 13th. They moved it to November 1st and made that All Saints Day. And there is the suggestion maybe that when that was not entirely successful, because it was not, people loved Samhain, they kept to their Samhain traditions, then they established All Souls Day sometime later, and that is November 2nd. And the explanation for that was that, well, people wanted to honor both their own dead and the saints, but it seems a little too coincidental, I think, that they happened to set it on November 2nd.
Right. So, you know, we got the immigrants bringing over the traditions from both places. What other immigrant traditions would blend into this thing that we now call Halloween?
Yeah, by about the 14th, 15th century, we know that they had indeed managed to sort of co-opt Samhain, and it had blended with the Catholic holiday. And then there along comes the witch trials that happened throughout Europe and so forth. A lot of times I get questions about why are witches associated with Halloween. That's a kind of a creepy story too, because it was a political act. King James of Scotland, who later became the King of England, was looking for a way to separate himself from the Catholic Church. And he was also obsessed with witches and demons. He wrote an entire book called Demonology. And it isn't until witch trials under King James that we start to see these things about witches celebrating their Sabbaths on Halloween, or as it was then sometimes known, All Saints Day, All Saints Eve, that kind of thing. So that's where we get witches coming into it. That's about the 16th century. And then in the 19th century, there are these terrible famines that happen in Europe and the UK, and it sends a lot of immigrants to America. We get the Scottish and the Irish people in the 1840s suddenly flooding into America, and they were bringing this holiday with them because they loved Halloween by then. It was a huge party time for them. We have some fabulous descriptions of what Halloween was like in the 18th century, and it sounds really fun. They would gather on the evening, they would dance, they would eat special foods, and they would play a lot of these fortune-telling games. So when they came to America, they brought this with them. And throughout the next few decades, in the middle of the 19th century, that kind of spread into all of American society, and Halloween started to become very popular.
Some of those games, I think, would include Snapdragon, which would have one an apple on one end and an open flame on the other end for the kids to play.
Yeah, some of the games were really scary. Snapdragon actually was one where they took a plate of little bits of food like nuts and raisins and maybe some apple slices or something, and they poured brandy on top of them and they lit it on fire, and the kids had to try and pull things out of it. I mean, it's nuts. And another one that I hear about and I just think, what, was called Snap Apple. And that was the one where they hung an apple on a string from overhead. So instead of bobbing for apples, which is already kind of dangerous anyway, in, you know, an apple floating in a tub of water, they were trying to grab an apple that's swinging from a string. And I mean, you can only imagine how many teeth people must have lost as a result of a snap apple.
Just a good old wholesome family fun. Yeah, just stick your face in the open flames. A little less safe back then. Now, how does Guy Fawkes figure in? Does it factor into how we celebrate Halloween these days at all, or am I off base there?
It actually kind of did play into it for a while. I don't think it has a huge impact on the American celebration, but what this was, Guy Fawkes Day was celebrated on November 5th in Great Britain. It commemorated a failed attempt to blow up the Houses of Parliament. It was a conspiracy. One of the leaders of the conspiracy was the gentleman who happened to be caught with the 36 barrels of gunpowder beneath the Houses of Parliament. He was named Guy Fawkes. And that's why this particular commemoration was named after him. And this happened, I think, in the early 17th century, and it was, again, that time when England was looking to separate themselves from the Catholic Church, and they banned all of the major Catholic celebrations, including All Saints Day, but they ended up almost replacing it with this Guy Fawkes Day, which had a lot of similarity to Halloween. It was celebrated with parties and bonfires and particular foods, and kids would go out and beg material to build their bonfires with by dressing up. And so they would smear soot on their faces and put on like beggar's rags. And they would go from house to house and they would ask for either money to buy materials or for wood to build their bonfires with. And there is often a thing where people want to draw a direct tie between that and trick-or-treat. We can talk about trick-or-treat and we will realize that there is no direct tie. Another thing that I hear a lot is that trick-or-treat dates back hundreds of years to a practice called souling, or soul-caking. Again, this is not really true. It sounds like it could have been because souling was a practice where kids on All Souls Day would go from house to house. Again, they would paint themselves as beggars, because this practice had started with beggars who would go from house to house and offer to say prayers for the souls of your loved ones who might be trapped in purgatory. And they would be given a little cake for this service. And then kids started doing this. Again, no direct tie. And we will talk about shortly here where trick-or-treat comes from and why it is strictly American.
Well, yeah, it's... And now what about the jack-o'-lantern as part of the iconography of Halloween? Where do we get, how's that factor into it?
Yeah, the jack-o'-lantern comes from the Irish side of things. The Irish love to play pranks on Halloween, and they love to do that, I think, because they blamed it on the fairies. They would say that the fairies had come over and would do these terrible evil things on Halloween, and they were just playful mischief things. They would do things like tie a string to a cabbage and pull it through a dark cabbage field at night to startle somebody. And one of the things that they loved to do was play on a classic story of Jack the Trickster, who was also known as Stingy Jack. He goes by a lot of different names. The most basic version of the story of him is that he was kind of a drunk and a carouser, and the devil came for his soul three times, and Jack tricked the devil out of taking his soul three times, but he finally dies. So when he dies, obviously heaven isn't going to let this guy in, and the devil doesn't want him either. And the devil ends up just throwing him this burning hell ember and saying, "That's all you get from me. You can use that to light your way." So Jack the Trickster puts this burning hell ember in this gourd that he's carrying and uses that to light his way as his spirit eternally roams the earth. And so that idea of that burning ember inside that gourd, because they didn't have pumpkins in Ireland, is where we get the jack-o'-lantern from. So when the Irish came to America and they saw these gorgeous New World fruit called pumpkins that were big and super easy to carve, because they were carving these like turnip things in Ireland that were much smaller and much harder to carve, it just kind of became natural that that pumpkin would become the jack-o'-lantern. And it wasn't immediately a part of Halloween. It kind of, for a long time, kids in America would carve these jack-o'-lanterns and just use them to play pranks that might or might not be associated with Halloween. When they really become firmly associated with Halloween is the early 20th century, when retailing comes in and suddenly postcard manufacturers and decoration companies that make decorations are looking for something to pin the holiday on that they can sell. And they come up with the jack-o'-lantern. And it's interesting that before those retailers come along, we can find these early party guides for Halloween that say the colors of Halloween are yellow and brown, because those were what was associated with harvest at the time, with corn husks and corn and scarecrows and hay and that kind of thing. So it took these retailers really latching on to the big orange jack-o'-lantern pumpkin to make the pumpkin kind of the king icon of Halloween.
I'm glad I did, because orange and black is so much better.
It sure is.
And now, yeah, to circle back now to the other main tradition here in the States of trick-or-treating. Yeah, let's get into that some.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest misconceptions that I hear all the time. I already mentioned I hear people say, "Oh, it's souling. Oh, it's Guy Fawkes." I've even heard people say it goes back to the Druids 2,000 years ago. I'm sorry, it does not. What it comes from is that Halloween in the first part of the 20th century in America was about prank playing. Boys all over the country had adopted the Irish idea of playing pranks on Halloween. And the pranks had started being kind of innocent and fun. They would do these crazy things like disassemble a gate at the front of your yard and then reassemble it like on top of your barn or in the middle of Main Street in town. They would tip over outhouses. They would rattle things against your window to scare you. And so it was kind of fun and innocent for a while, but then it moved into the cities. And when it moved into the cities, it became setting fires and destroying light fixtures and windows and even tripping people on sidewalks. And it was costing cities all over America millions of dollars worth of damage. It was so bad in like 1933, which is the height of the Great Depression. Cities don't have a lot of money anyways. Newspapers all over the country called it Black Halloween that year. And a lot of cities were trying to ban the holiday. They'd had it. They couldn't afford to keep up with it anymore. But a few of them had a much smarter idea and said, maybe we can buy these kids off.
Right.
And so by the mid-30s, we get some of the cities are starting to actually put out little pamphlets that they are giving to homeowners that are suggesting these things called house-to-house parties. And the house-to-house parties were because it was the Great Depression and people didn't have a lot of money, it was a way that they could come together to share the expenses. So the first house would give the kids like a really basic, silly costume, like a sheet to be a ghost. The next house might give the kids some games to play. The next house might give them a really simple haunted attraction, which would just be like the kids would go through a dark basement. And then the last house might give them a little treat or even a simple meal of some kind. And this worked. This caught on. It did not catch on immediately, which is interesting. It actually did take a while for it to really become accepted across the U.S., and then World War II gets in the way on top of it. So it's really not until the end of World War II that we see trick-or-treat has spread all over the country and is now accepted as the way to buy kids off and keep them from playing pranks.
Right.
So again, strictly American, very modern. The notion of costuming does not have a huge historical precedent. It's just that in the early part of the 20th century, people loved to dress up. It was a really common practice. They did it for many holidays. They did it for Thanksgiving and Christmas. They did it for school pageants and parades and all kinds of things. So it just was natural to dress kids up for Halloween. It was one more way to give them something fun to do.
It's not to hide them from the monsters that get to roam the earth one night only.
My mom told me that one, too, and I love that explanation, but it's unfortunately not really.
Yeah, that's... So, you know, you have like New Orleans, New York, Las Vegas. I'm trying to figure out which one of these would be the Halloween capital of the world. It turns out Anoka, Minnesota. Should have thought of that right off. I don't know. How did that come about?
Yeah, Anoka kind of anointed themselves with that. They actually went to, I think, the federal Congress and got themselves designated that way. And that was a century ago, and they have been celebrating ever since. In terms of the actual, like, size, I think it's possible that the biggest Halloween celebration in the U.S. is now West Hollywood, which has been the case for a while. That draws around 500,000 people on most years. I know there are also, there's a huge one in Key West, Florida as well, but I think West Hollywood has taken the number one spot as the biggest celebration, but Anoka does it really well. They do a lot of parades and month-long events. Salem, Massachusetts also does month-long events for Halloween and certainly could have a claim to being secondary Halloween capital, I think.
Yeah, it's got a kick out. Like, of all the spooky places or party places, I'm like, yeah, no, Minnesota, sure. Why not?
Yeah.
Small town Minnesota at that. Yeah. This is wonderful holiday that's come in from all sides, and I think it's unique. It's unique in and of itself. Now, this you can't say that it's one to draw a parallel line to one thing to make it what it is today. I think it's its own unique holiday at this point. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, it is definitely unique, and I get asked all the time if it's related to something like Día de los Muertos in Mexico. It is like a distant cousin. And Día de los Muertos is interesting because it's what happens when you take these same missionaries, Catholic missionaries, coming in to convert some indigenous people, but they're coming into Latin America instead of the British Isles. And the existing native people in Mexico, the Mayan and Aztec tribes, had their own celebrations, like the Celts had Samhain. And so part of the Catholic missionary's job was to co-opt those celebrations. And we get those mixing with All Souls and All Saints Day, and it's a very different holiday. And it's interesting because it shares some things with Halloween, but not a lot. It's a much more somber holiday. It really is about commemorating the souls of your loved ones who have passed on. It's believed that they come back, that on that day you would put out their favorite foods and drink for them, and that you would go and clean their graves in the graveyard. It is playful as well. It mocks death. It makes fun of death. That's where we get all of the playful and colorful skeleton imagery associated with Día de los Muertos. And but it was never about kids or trick-or-treating or prank playing. That is all very American, dating back to the Irish and Scottish.
Oh, fantastic. And thanks for coming on today and talking to us about this wonderful holiday. And where can people find your books?
You can start at lisamorton.com. That is super easy, but they are available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble and bookshop.org, all the major retailers. And I would just recommend that people start with Trick or Treat, A History of Halloween. There we go, which is a nice, low-priced, affordable paperback. And I have also written a massive encyclopedia, but it's really expensive and huge and best served for, saved for universities and libraries.
Yeah, and Trick or Treat was just excellent. I loved it to death. And, man, thank you so much for coming on, and hopefully we can have you back again.
Yeah, I loved you. Thanks a lot, Alan.
All right. Wow, what a privilege that was. I think we shined a little light on this dark and mysterious day, and I hope you came away better informed as well as entertained. And I can't thank Lisa enough for coming on the show. She was just an absolute delight. And hey, you know what? If you enjoyed this, please hit that like button and share it with anyone you know with a curious mind who might appreciate it. Subscribe to the channel if you haven't already, and check out the back episodes. And keep an eye out. I've been putting out shorts on YouTube, and you might have a couple of surprise drops this holiday season. And remember, as we part ways this week, be careful, because it can get dark out there.